Welcome to Shetland with Laurie, a podcast dedicated to Shetland, the place and the people, with me, Laurie Goodland, a writer and tour guide based at 60 degrees north. The Shetland with Laurie podcast is for people who have visited Shetland, or who would like to visit, or for those who would just like to know a little bit more about life here. So welcome, I'm so glad you're here. Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the podcast. Today we have a very special guest and a fascinating topic to explore. Today I welcome Bill Moore, a local historian, on to speak to us about the history of the Shetland Bus, which was an undercover operation between Shetland and Nazi-occupied Norway during the Second World War. It's a fascinating episode and I really enjoyed taking a deeper look into this period of our history with Bill. So without further ado, let's welcome him to the podcast. So hello, Billy, and welcome to today's show. Thank you very much for agreeing to come on and speak to us a bit more about the Shetland Bus operation, which was, as we'll hear, a crucial element of the Second World War. And I'm really pleased that, as I said, that you've agreed to do this for me, because I know that for many people visiting Shetland, it's something that they're really interested in finding out more about. And as well, a lot of people that come here are maybe unaware of kind of how important the Shetland Bus operation was. But firstly, could you just introduce yourself and tell us kind of where your interest in the Shetland Bus comes from?
Yes, well, thank you for inviting me here. Hi, my name is Bill Moore. I was born and bred here in Shetland in Scalloway. But I lived most of my life in the south of England in pharmaceutical R&D and then retired and came back. So my interest in the Shetland Bus really goes back to the time I was born, because my father was involved in the shore side of operations, and so I was brought up with all the stories. You ask, what was the Shetland Bus? Well, I think the definition is pretty important. It was a nickname, and it was a sort of a nickname, I think, awarded originally by the Norwegians to a top secret operation set up in World War II to establish a sort of a transport system between Shetland and occupied Norway.
This is the point that we say it wasn't a bus, because quite often people think that it's going to be buses.
You're absolutely right. Yes, a lot of people think that the Shetland Bus, even if it was not a bus, that it was one particular boat, but it's not. It's really a nickname short for the Shetland Bus operation. There was a whole fleet of fishing boats. But to go back to the beginning, really, before World War II, Norway and the Scandinavian countries were neutral. But suddenly, Norway was invaded in April 1940. Now, this came as a shock to all of us in the West. It was not expected. And Churchill realized that when in the occupied countries, he needed a new organization to act as subversives, almost, to fight the occupier in the occupied countries. But this was to be a clandestine operation. He already had the Secret Service, the SIS or MI6, but they were mostly involved in intelligence work. He needed a comparable operation which had teeth, you might say. It would be able to carry out sabotage, to train the resistance, to supply arms and munitions, radios, and so on. And so he set up this operation after the invasion of France, and he called it the SOE, the Special Operations Executive. So when Norway was suddenly occupied, then he appointed a venerable old gentleman, Colonel Wilson, to set up the Norwegian side of things, to become the head of Norway's SOE. In addition to setting up the Shetland Bus, he, of course, was the man responsible for organising the sabotage of the heavy water plant at Vimork, Telemark, and the destruction of the heavy water plant, of course, was vitally important because that really prevented the Germans in progressing with their nuclear research into the atomic bomb. And although we didn't know at the time just how strategically important it was, we now know that it was vital that that plant be destroyed, that the heavy water did not reach Germany. But that was a very successful mission carried out by Norwegian agents and dropped by air. None was killed at all. It was a completely successful mission. And Colonel Wilson realized that one way to do it, possibly, was to use Shetland as the base. Shetland is the nearest point of UK land to Norway. Use mm-hmm. Shetland as the base and maybe use some of the many fishing boats that were coming across from Norway, because after the occupation, a lot of people who had resisted had to escape. Most went to Sweden, but an awful lot from the west coast came to Shetland. Shetland was the nearest land, came in fishing boats or, oh gosh, anything that they could beg, borrow or steal. Some even, we found empty kayaks. So there was, a lot of people were desperate to escape. Yeah. So many of these fishing boats that arrived with the refugees, and in total there were something like 3,500 Norwegian refugees who arrived. A lot of these fishing boats, right at the very early stages, actually went back to Norway to pick up more refugees, because if you've looked at the coastline of Norway, you'll see that it's an impossibly difficult place for an occupier to police, with thousands and thousands of islands and secluded areas. And also, Norway at that time had something like, I think, 30,000 fishing boats, some huge number of fishing boats. So for the Germans to keep tabs on those was really quite impossible. So they realized that the fishing boats could provide a lifeline between Shetland and occupied Norway. It could be used to supply the resistance in Norway with the arms, munitions, supplies of all sorts, land agents, bring back refugees, and build up the resistance in Norway. Ultimately, the aim would have been that if the resistance could be built up, then at some point they could be able to rise internally against the invader. No one knew how long the war would last. It could be a few years, could be 10 years. So this really was the basis of the Shetland bus.
And what were these kind of early missions? What did they look like? I mean, we're thinking about small wooden fishing boats and often quite a treacherous journey that they'd be undertaking under the darkness in the winter. I mean, what would it have looked like for these men that were ferrying the boats back and forth across the North Sea?
They were a remarkable group of lads. They were very young, average age, only young, early 20s, I think. Some were even in their teens. They were all volunteers. That's the important thing about the Shetland bus men. They were not enlisted men. They were very often fishermen and engineers, people of that sort, who wanted to do something to fight back. They all had been trained. They all went down to England and Scotland for training. So they were pretty competent, but nonetheless, they were just ordinary people. All the missions had to be carried out in winter because the fishing boat, if it was going to be successful, it had to get into the zone along the coast of Norway, patrolled by the Germans. Now, providing it to slip into that zone of about, I think about 30, 40 miles, then it could pass as a Norwegian fishing boat, and it would use its innocent looks as its disguise.
Yeah.
So, but all this had to be carried out, if possible, under cover of darkness, and that meant that the operations could only take place in the winter. And in the winter here, the weather can be absolutely terrible. So it was it was a high risk. And with the Germans patrolling the coastline by air, it was sometimes difficult to know who was the worst enemy, the German aircraft or the weather. One was almost as bad as the other.
And how long would the journey across take?
It will depend. Norway's coast is very, very long. But the minimum time would be 24 hours each way. That would be straight across to the Bergen region. Some of the trips were to the high Arctic, to Trenne, and one even to Tromsø. And that would took 4 or 5 days on the sea. So very, very long trips. These fishing boats were about sort of 50 to 70 feet long. And their speed was very slow by today's standards, just about 7-8 knots. So they were, it was a very arduous trips.
And in terms of when they arrived in Shetland, I mean, we sometimes think, or people sometimes assume that Shetland, because of its location, was somewhat isolated during the Second World War. But it really wasn't the case, and it was actually a hugely important strategic base for many wartime operations. But when these boats arrived in Shetland, where were they coming, and what were the kind of provision for them that were in place here when they arrived?
Well, the numbers began, of course, in 1940. Norway was invaded in April 1940, and they reached the peak in 1941. Now, there was a big problem because Shetland at that time was, as you say, strategically very important. We had almost, I think the numbers of military, British military who were stationed in Shetland was almost one for every inhabitant in the islands. So a huge number of military establishments. And then the Norwegians begin to arrive. So they hurriedly built a camp in Lerwick to accommodate them. But all the Norwegians who came here had to go to London for interrogation, for debriefing, as it was called, because right at the start, the Germans were pretty quick to realize that they could use fishing boats in reverse. They could use fishing boats to land Nazis in the UK. And this they tried with some success right from the very start.
Okay.
So all Norwegians, they soon learned that all Norwegians had to go to London and then they would scatter, they would do whatever their trade was, or they would perhaps join the Norwegian forces, the Norwegian Air Force or Navy or the Merchant Navy, or some came back to Shetland and joined the Shetland Gang, as the Norwegians called them.
Mm-hmm. And when they came to Shetland, where were they going? Where were the bases that the boats landed?
Right. Well, the Shetland bus started in 1940, and it was actually headed by the Secret Service, by Leslie Mitchell of the SIS, rather than the SOE. And he set up a base in Lerwick. Now, he very quickly realized that if you're a member of the MI6, the SIS, secrecy is your overriding priority. And Lerwick was so busy with so much naval activity that he realized Lerwick was no place for a top secret operation. Lerwick undoubtedly had its spies as well. Mm-hmm. So later in 1940, at the beginning of 1941, he appointed a sub-lieutenant David Howarth as his second in command. And David Howarth has become strongly associated with the Shetland bus after he wrote the book called The Shetland Bus way back in 1951, I think it was. So they decided that they had to relocate somewhere. So they found a place, Lunna, which is up in the northeast mainland of Shetland, good proximity to Norway, excellent anchorage, a big house which could accommodate about 30 men. There were about 30 involved at that stage, but it had its drawbacks because an operation such as the Shetland bus needed an awful lot of maintenance, a lot of engineering and ship working maintenance, because these boats were coming back sometimes, if not shot to pieces, then suffering because of the weather and everything else. So they went to Lanark, which satisfied a lot of the requirements. Certainly the secrecy one was perfect from that respect. And there it worked for, there it carried on for one winter. But in the spring of 1942, they realized that it was getting very difficult to use Lanna as a base for practical reasons. Mm-hmm. For one thing, in November of 1941, there was a terrible storm in Shetland. One of the worst, November 1941 was probably one of the worst months of the whole century. We have the weather reports from UNST for that month, and of the 30 days in November, 26 were either gale, severe gale, storm, or hurricane.
Wow.
And many of the boats were blown ashore. Seven boats, I think, were blown ashore. And actually, in that November, trucks were blown off the road and things. It was a pretty wild month. And it just so happened that there was some Norwegian visitors came to Lanna just after this storm, and they made a damning report on the state of affairs, as you can imagine, because the boats were lying on the beach.
Yeah.
And they couldn't get at them. Lanna was very remote. It was difficult to access. And my father, who had an engineering business here in Scalloway, he had had to go to Lanna many times to do repairs. And he always said that he couldn't understand how any operation could run from there. And he described Lanna as a graveyard of boats, which was not very complimentary.
No.
Anyhow, in the spring of 42, they decided they needed a better, from the point of view of maintenance and repairs, base. And that's why they came to Scalloway here. Well, this is the wrong, Scalloway is on the wrong side of Shetland. It's on the west side. So you've got to, it takes you an extra hour or more to go around the headland to either the south or the north before you're into the North Sea. But nonetheless, I think if you're involved in trips that last anything up to several days, an hour or two is not of any consequence. So,
yeah, and as you said, if they were to go into Larwick, they would have been under the scrutiny of so many eyes, which could have been eyes of spies, or whereas Scalloway was much smaller and just a bit more discreet in that sense.
You're exactly right. Scalloway had, we think, about 730 inhabitants, and they all knew each other, and they all knew everybody else's business. And also Scalloway was a restricted, doubly restricted village. You needed a permit to leave it, and needed papers to enter. So there was not a lot of movement in those days. People did go into Lerwick, of course, but there was, and people, as far as the Shetland bus went, when the base came to Scalloway, people knew what was going on, but you just didn't speak about it. So it was, when they came to Scalloway, there were at any one time, maybe 60, 70, 80 young lads, Norwegians. Here, they came to a village which had quite an active social life. There were dances nearly every week and so on. So these lads, they had as good a time as they could have done under the circumstances. Whereas at Lanna, they had nothing. There was nothing at all other than sheep. So.
No, that's true. And then, of course, in Scalloway, they had the boat building yard, so they could carry out the kind of essential repairs and maintenance that was so desperately lacking when they were at Lanna.
That's exactly right, yes. It was really, I suppose, this is my father's yard, and I should think that's probably the main reason why they came here, because of the great need for continual maintenance. And also, there were, at Lanna, I don't think they had electricity, which was, and the pier, they could only get there at high tide. So it had a lot of disadvantages. But here in Scalloway, these lads really made it their home. They just became part of village life. And that's one reason why today there are still strong ties between a lot of people in the village and the descendants of those Shetland busmen.
Some of the Norwegian men that came here, they stayed here and they had families, and the connections are kind of maintained today.
That's right, yes. Well, during the war, there were something of the order of 800 Norwegians based in Shetland. There were something like 500 at the seaplane base up at Sulum. There were a couple of hundred from 1942-43 in Lerwick. Norwegian Navy had a base of motor torpedo boats, a flotilla of MTBs. So a couple of hundred there, and then there were anything up to 100 here in Skalloway. So it's an awful lot of Norwegians. In total, I think there was something like 24, 25 marriages during the war, of which there were three in Skalloway here. Some of the families are here in Shetland, some of the families are in Norway, some are scattered between the two countries.
So do we have any idea how many were sunk to the Nazis, and how many were kind of lost to the North Sea and the weather?
I've often meant to do that to work out that statistics. But of the boats, about half of the boats were lost one way or the other. Some, a combination of both, because if they were weakened by air attack, then the weather would finish them off, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to say, really, but several of the boats were lost to the weather, we know that, and quite a few to the Luftwaffe.
In terms of the kind of successes, how many people did they manage to take out of Norway? And how many successful missions were made?
Well, in total, they made something like 216, I think, missions. Now, some were successful and some were not successful for a whole variety of reasons. One of the problems was communication with Norway was almost non-existent at that time. So by the time you got a message, things could have changed dramatically in Norway. So it was very difficult to maintain, to know exactly what was going on at any one time. But the boats, the main reason, the purpose, as I say, was a sort of a transport system. So there were landing agents and supplies to the resistance in Norway. And they learned right from the start that the only real safe way to do this was to use the outer islands, use the island. Don't go into the fjords, because that would be very dangerous. If you go in, you might never be able to come out again because of all the German posts, lookout posts and so on. And so they learned that right at the start. So they'd use the outer islands, and then the resistance could come out, or the islanders could deliver any goods supplied there or the agents to the mainland when it was safe to do so. Some of the early trips, the stories involved are really legion, and a lot of them have probably never been told too.
Yeah, there's probably just still so much that they're still unearthing.
Indeed, yes. Not everything has come to light yet by any means.
There was a change in how the operation took place when we got gifted subchasers in 1943. But before we come on to the subchasers, could you just maybe tell us about some of the early missions and maybe some of the kind of stories that we have from these earlier days of the Shetland bus?
All in all, there were great successes, and there were great adventures and terrible tragedies. For example, the loss of the Blia, a fishing boat, which had gone across to pick up a schoolmaster who was very heavily involved with the resistance, and the Gestapo were on his heels. When they went to pick him up, there were 80 people on the quay who were desperate to get to Shetland. The boat was the most unsuitable boat for the purpose. The schoolmaster had to use his own weapon, his own gun, to keep half his fellow Norwegians on the quay. They allowed 37 of them to come on board, which was far too many for the boat, but they had to leave. And they only got about, we reckon, 10 miles off the Norwegian coast when the boat sank, and the loss, all lives were lost. So tragedies of that sort happen too.
Yeah. And I think that the story of the Blia just, it just kind of hits home the desperation that some people felt that to get out of Norway and to try and make that journey, because it would have been filled with trepidation.
Filled with trepidation. The problem was that these people who had been kept back on the quay, they could not go back home. Norwegians had to report into the occupier every day, and if they were missing for a day, then that was it. There was no way they could ever go back. So it was a one-way trip to escape.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the other half of the group, they hid in the mountains in the Bømlo area, and they were able to be rescued about a week later by, and they came to Shetland. But unfortunately, the ones in the Blia were lost. In our museum in Skalloway, when it opened by the Norwegian Prime Minister in 2012, there was an old man, Olsen. He was a retired dentist, and he stood at the desk in the museum and told us that he was a 17-year-old student, and he was one of the ones kept ashore at gunpoint.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was alive today.
Amazing.
Because of that stroke of luck on his part, that he wasn't allowed to board. Yeah.
And for people like him, in some ways, it'll feel like nearly a bit of a pilgrimage to come back. It would just evoke so many emotions to come back to the place that rescued them.
Mm, absolutely. The Shetland bus is really a series of remarkable stories. Almost every mission, there were over 200 in total, almost every one was an adventure in its own right, because these boats, starting off for the first couple of years with fishing boats, and then, as you said, later on with sub chasers, they were entering enemy territory, and they knew that if they were caught, they were not going to be treated very lightly. In fact, before Shetland bus started in 1940, two agents who were taken across to Norway were captured in Bergen, and they were executed. And that was right at the very start of operation. So these men knew what was in store. If they were caught, they would be executed. Only one boat was captured, and the crew of that boat spent the rest of the war in prison camp in Germany, and they actually survived the war. But that was a special case. Everyone else who was caught was killed. They knew the risks they were taking, but I suppose most young people, they think all these things, bad things only happen to somebody else, not to me.
Yeah.
The one boat, the Nordsjøen, was sent across on a mine-laying expedition. That was the one and only time they did that. They decided that these fishing boats were not equipped for laying mines. They laid their mines successfully, and on their way back from Norway, the weather deteriorated and the boat began to come apart at the seams. So by good luck than anything else, they managed to get back to the coast to Norway, and they got some shelter among some islands, and then the boat sank. Now, fortunately, they were able to get in the lifeboat and get ashore. So here's the crew stranded on this island. The skipper and his mate, the skipper was called Gjertsen and the mate Merkesdal. The other members of the crew were headed by a man who became famous in later years, Leif Larsen. He was a man who earned so many British medals that he was one of the most decorated men in World War II.
Okay.
Anyhow, these they landed on this island, and the boat was sinking, but next morning they realized that the masts were sticking out of the water, so the Germans would know. And so they were in pretty grave danger and they had to get out quick. Jerksen and Merkersdal, the skipper, they abandoned the rest of the crew and set off on their own. And they had a pretty grueling trip. It took them 3 weeks over mountains. They were snowed up in a hut for 5 days, I think, and they eventually got to an island, and eventually, about a month later, they got back to Shetland with their fiancés. So I think it became clear that what the reason for their escape from the crew was. But anyhow, because of that, they were dismissed from the service because of the lack of leadership. But the interesting thing is that the other part of the crew, they were led by Leif Larsen. Now, he at that time was just a crewman, but they had a pretty hair-raising escape too, and they traveled 100 miles to the village of one of the other crewmen, who said his father would probably be able to find the boat and they would get back to Shetland. Well, they eventually reached the village through some pretty hair-raising escapes. They passed the whole troop of German trucks and so on, and then just sailed past them and got through it. But this was the sort of luck they had. And they got to the village, and the crewman's father couldn't find a boat for them. But there was a boat lying at anchor, and she was all equipped, ready, fueled up, ready to go to the cod fishing in the far north. And so one night, they found out the Gestapo were in the village hunting them, and they decided just to take this boat. The boat was called the Arthur, and she became pretty famous later on for other reasons. And it was a fine night. They realized if they started the engine, then the Germans would immediately know where they were. And just by sheer good luck, the RAF decided to have a bombing raid. And under that cover, they were able to get on board the Arthur and set sail for Shetland. So Larsen came back with the Arthur, and that was his boat for the rest of the war. She was very famous in later for being the boat in which they had an attempt to sink the Tirpitz, blow up the Tirpitz. Tirpitz was an enormous battleship, German battleship. And Churchill, our British Prime Minister, his main objective was to destroy that battleship. She was such a threat to the Russian convoys, to the shipping in the North Atlantic. She was based in Norway, and he decided that it was almost a national obsession to destroy that boat. Well, in short, it took 24 missions before she was finally destroyed. But one of those missions was using a fishing boat, and it was the Arthur, when I mentioned, that had been stolen by Leif Larsen. Larsen was the skipper. They would decided that they would tow two little mini electric submarines, which were manned by two divers on top. It was recirculating air, so very high tech at the time. They would tow these into the fjord where the Tirpitz lay in Norway, and then, under cover of darkness, the divers would go down on the subs and they would head underwater to the Tirpitz. They would attach limpet bombs onto the hull of the Tirpitz, then steam back to shore or back to the fishing boat, and then they would all escape. Well, it was the most daring episode imaginable. They almost succeeded. They got through in very intensive German questioning about why they were there and so on. And they got to almost within sight of the Tirpitz when they turned around the headland, hit three enormous waves, and the cables which were carrying the submarines snapped. The submarines fell to the bottom of the fjord. none of the crewmen was lost, but the whole mission had to be abandoned. And then, so they were in the wrong place, the wrong time. The escape had to be thrown out the window. So Larsen and the agents who were sub drivers and the crewmen managed to escape to Sweden over the mountains. One man, Bob Evans, was shot just at the Swedish border, and he was put into hospital by the Germans and then taken out and shot. And this was the fate that they knew they suffered. The other crewmen got into Sweden and eventually came back to Shetland. This is just one of the stories. There are others like that, like the loss of the Bratholm is a harrowing story, which has now been made into two films, how these 11 men were tortured and executed in Tromsø in the far north, but one agent, Jan Baalsrud, escaped to Sweden, and his escape is so remarkable that it's become almost legendary, and you can now join Jan Baalsrud hikes and so on, following his trail over from north of Norway across to Sweden. I think this happens every July. So but that story is a remarkable story, and as I say, that one again has been told. But there were the fishing boats themselves have gone down in history, because they had different skippers sometimes. And they were all, as I say, these were volunteers. So that they were a democratic system. The crewmen chose the skipper. And one of the first missions was a boat called the Axel. And she made about 11 trips before she was finally lost. And on her last trip to the high Arctic, she gave her position as just to the north of Shetland, and then came a message, send help.
Okay.
So a massive air and sea rescue operation was set off from Shetland, but they were spotted by a seaplane with the boat almost sinking and the crew in the rafts. But the boat, the weather was too bad, the seaplane couldn't land, it went back to report, and by the time rescue boats came, there was no trace, so they were never seen again. And this was not unusual.
And was this just as a result of the weather rather than enemy attack?
We think it was the weather, yes. Yeah. It was a pretty stormy day. But the Germans, when they realized that the boat had been lost, especially if it had escaped the people on board and had been lost, they usually made a claim that they'd sunk it, but they did that anyhow, so you can never be sure.
Yeah.
Some boats like the Seaglaus, she actually survived the war, but twice her wheelhouse was blown up mostly by the weather, and twice she was rebuilt. So it was remarkable what these boats went through, and some of them did survive right till the end.
It's incredible, and it's like you said earlier, every single mission has an extraordinary story associated with it, and it's just the bravery and equal measures of good practice and good luck, and it's
a bit of bravado as well, I think. So
yeah.
There's the story of the Televåg tragedy, which again has gone down in history. That is one of the World War II's worst acts of retribution by the Germans. The Olaf, skippered by a very popular man, Per Brista, and Arne Melkovic, who married a local girl, she set off from here with two agents. They landed the Norwegian agents. Landed them at this village of Televåg, but then came back to Shetland, and that was fine. The agents, a week later, were still in this village when the Gestapo came. There was a fight. They were arrested. They were arrested, and there was a shooting, and a very important Gestapo officer was shot. Now, the repercussions on that village were just horrendous. The Germans destroyed all the houses, blew them all up. There were 72 men were, and the boys were from the age of 16 to 60 were taken away to a prison camp in Germany, where half of them died. All the women and children were put in prison camp in Norway for 2 years. Now, all of this because one Gestapo officer had been shot.
Yeah.
So this was a terrible price to have to pay. But that was one of the problems with the SOE, with saboteurs, because the reprisals could make it almost hardly worthwhile carrying out the sabotage. But yeah, they were willing. They knew that this the only way to defeat the enemy was to carry on and do as much damage as they could.
Yeah, just incredibly difficult decisions to make, and yeah, the repercussions could be catastrophic.
Very difficult. Very difficult.
Yeah.
So it was a mixture of all these successes, adventures and tragedies, which make up a wonderful story.
Yeah. And then it changed in 1943, and they stopped using the kind of fishing boats, and we got three subchasers. Can you tell us about the subchasers, what a subchaser is, and how that changed the dynamics of the operation?
Yeah, it changed the dynamics really, because fishing boats, they relied for, their innocence was their disguise. But by 1943, by the end of 1942, the Germans were very much aware of what was going on. They just couldn't catch them. And but also that winter, the winter of 1942-43, the losses of fishing boats were far too high to sustain. We had lost the Bergholm, although the crew, apart from one man, did survive. The Bratholm has gone down in history. There's been two films made about the loss of the Bratholm. Again, there, the 11 men, including four agents, were all executed in Tromsø. That was a very severe loss. And Sandoy, another quite a big boat, set off to the Arctic and laden with explosives, and she disappeared. Locals said that there was a fight with aircraft, so presumably a bomb, a shell hit the explosives, and she disappeared. This all in one winter, it was becoming unsustainable. And the crewmen still wanted to carry on. They said, well, give us faster boats, bigger boats. We're too slow. We can't evade the German patrol boats. But we had nothing to offer. We had motor torpedo boats, and they were about 100 feet long, 110 feet long, fast, very fast. And the Norwegian Navy had a flotilla of those in Lerwick. But they were really fair weather craft in the sense that they were not built for the North Sea in winter. They were built for much calmer waters. And although they did a lot of patrols and sort of hit and miss runs across the North Sea, they were very dependent on the weather being and the sea being fairly reasonably calm. So we had nothing, no boats we could offer them. And this is where the Americans came to the rescue, and Roosevelt donated three of these wooden ships. They were about 110 feet long warships, very heavily armed. They were called subchasers because they were built originally as chasing submarines with depth charge laying apparatus and so on. But in the Shetland bus, the submarines were never an issue. There was the problem arose because of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. The problems. So these three subchasers were donated. They came across here and they were fitted out, heavily armed. with anti-aircraft weaponry. Now, you cannot disguise that. That there is no innocence about such a warship.
No.
So you change your strategy, and instead of a strategy of deceit and disguise, you just use the formidable appearance of the craft. But the beauty of the subchasers was that they were fast, very fast, and they could get in to the coast and get out again, and nothing the Germans had could equal them in speed. So they stood a chance, and they were very heavily armed. And in fact, it was said that if the Luftwaffe pilot saw one of these, he would think twice before he attacked. He would realize he would probably come off worse. So it was a change in strategy. But it's really at that time that this develops the name the Shetland Bus, because those subchasers were able to almost set up what amounted to a bus service. They were so regular in the trips that they made.
And did the dynamic of how they were crewed change? Because you mentioned when they were using the fishing boats before 1943, that all the young men were volunteers. They were fishermen that were volunteering their time and their boats and their energy into carrying out these missions. And did they stay with the operation as we see the subchasers coming in?
Yes, they did. The vast majority did. The subchasers they were handed over by the Americans to the Norwegian Navy. You can't imagine the Americans handing over three of these lovely warships to a bunch of volunteers. It doesn't work like that. So they were handed over to the Navy, and that meant the Norwegian Navy had a part to play now, because before that it did not. The Shetland Bus was entirely organized, set up by the British, and carried out by the Norwegian volunteers. This was the unusual aspect of it. But now that the Navy, Norwegian Navy, was involved, they were more or less at a distance. The only point made was that they had to be skippered by a Norwegian officer. Now, two of the Shetland Bus men had happened to be in the Norwegian Navy, so they qualified. The third skipper was, they didn't have a naval officer to be skipper, but the obvious one to be skipper was Leif Larsen. He already had just about every British honour that could be bestowed on him, and Norwegian, and he was a very good leader. And the British said, well, okay, he's going to be the skipper. The Norwegians said, no, he doesn't qualify, he doesn't have the sub-lieutenant, he can't. And there was quite a heated meeting, I gather, here in Shetland. And the Norwegians were more or less told that Larsen was going to be skipper, whatever happened. But to do this, they just made Larsen a sub-lieutenant and sent him for a week's training down to Scotland, and that was it. He became the skipper of the third one.
Wow. And when the subchasers came, was there any more devastating losses of life?
No, you're right. When the subchasers came, everything changed. There were no more, they had their moments, and there were some pretty narrow escapes and some scrapes, but not a single life was lost after that. They carried many, many tons of arms, hundreds of tons of arms and munitions across, and agents, and brought back several, I think, close to over 300 refugees. But not a single life was lost after that. So it became, as I say, more or less a bus operation that was very, very successful.
Yeah, it seems like quite a slick operation.
It was indeed, yes, yes.
And then, of course, when the war ended, brought it to a close, but even today, we're still, or people like yourself are still unearthing kind of stories and the mysteries, because it was such a top secret operation. So a lot of things are still coming to light even now.
Well, yes, indeed. And there's still books being written. One, Tony Insull, just published a book. In fact, the paperback edition was published only last month, and it's an excellent read. It's called Secret Alliances. And that is based on a lot of the new information that he obtained from the British archives, Norwegian, and even the Russian archives. So still a lot of books have been written, especially Norwegian books, and many, many books in Norwegian. The first one was David Haworth back in 1951. As I said, he called it the Shetland Bus, and that's where the name stuck. Then about 5 years ago, Asgeir Uland, a Norwegian historian, did a lot of very detailed research, and he called his book Shetlandsgjengen, but unfortunately it has never been published in English, so it's you need to know your Norwegian.
Yeah.
But again, it was an excellent source of information. So yeah, and today the descendants of a lot of these men come back every year. It's great to meet them, and sometimes they come with little stories, but main now it's beginning to fade a bit. There's none, I think only one man left now who was involved in the Shetland Bus, one Norwegian. So it's almost history. One of these days it will be history.
Yeah. And it's very much the focus of much of the displays within the Skalawa Museum, and the archive that you hold there is phenomenal. It's a huge source of information, and people come to Shetland especially to have a look at the exhibitions and to find out more. And we have a memorial in the village that is dedicated to those that gave their life to the operation. So could you kind of explain a bit about the local involvement in kind of celebrating and remembering?
Yes, well, in 2002, we instituted a memorial to the 44 men of the Shetland Bus who were lost. That's 44 men. That does not include agents, refugees, so on, which would swell that number greatly, but 44 crewmen of the Shetland Bus. And this gave a focus. Before that, we didn't really have a focus in the village for the Shetland Bus, other than it was my father's workshops and so on. But that it wasn't a focal point. And before that, we had a museum in the village, and that museum featured the Shetland Bus quite naturally. So since 2002, we got a new museum underway. It was unveiled, inaugurated in 2012 by Stoltenberg, the Norwegian Prime Minister, now head of NATO. So he came across here to open the museum. And the museum, we have a excellent archive of papers. We have, I think it's something like 20,000 documents, mostly supplied. They're all electronic, mostly electronic. And they were given to us by Asgeir Uland, who had been to Kew to the National Archives and obtained them from there, and he gave us copies. So it's an excellent base for information. And we have a lot of photos, of course, which people have handed in. So all in all, it's a good base. And we tell the story as straightforwardly as possible. Though, as I say, it is such a big story that it's impossible to tell it in a museum context other than in the simplest form.
Yeah.
But it's very popular. It brings a lot of people to Shetland. Some people have come up. In fact, one couple about 2 years ago came into the museum one day, and they had flown up from London that morning on the first flight, and they were coming just to see the Shetland Bus exhibition in the museum. They were going back to London that night. So,
wow.
That was exceptional, I will admit. And of course, it's a focus for all the Norwegians who come to Shetland.
Yeah, and we do retain that really strong ties, and historically we have strong ties with Scandinavia, but in, as you said, these kind of recent history, we have like forged incredibly strong bonds through the Shetland Buffs.
Yes, we have indeed, and in Scalloway it has. But Shetland also, as I said, because of all these nearly 800 Norwegians based in Shetland, that they left their mark.
Now, I'm going to ask a big question, which you might not be able to answer. How important do you think the Shetland Buffs operation was in the context of a wider war?
That is a difficult question.
Sorry.
I think you could attack that from several angles. The occupation of Norway was very, very expensive for the Germans. There were, at a minimum, 10 divisions of German soldiers based in Norway. That's about 250,000 troops. With all the hangers-on and so on, I have seen numbers up to 500,000 Germans involved in Norway. Now, Norway doesn't really feature much in the war. You can imagine if those at least 300,000 were based elsewhere, the war might have taken a different course. But so why all the Germans based in Norway? Well, the Shetland Buffs played its part. The Shetland Buffs was a threat to Hitler. They felt in Norway that Britain would attack Norway and Shetland would be the base. The Germans must have known just how heavily militarized Shetland was. And of course, we in Shetland felt almost exactly the same. We were pretty sure that there was a good chance Hitler might invade the UK through Shetland and Orkney from the north. So I think the Shetland Buffs played an important part. It landed many, many agents. It trained up a lot of the Milorg and the Company Linga, the Norwegian resistance groups. And when war was finally ended, suddenly nearly all the towns in Norway, a whole groups of men appeared in uniform, which had all been brought across in the part of the Shetland Buffs, fully armed. So the handover of the country was a very uneventful event, so to speak.
Yeah.
I think the Shetland Buffs played a pretty important part in keeping all these Germans tied up in Norway.
And it's interesting locally as well, because I kind of mentioned earlier that we sometimes assumed that Shetland was an isolated place on the periphery of war, but actually when the Nazis invaded Norway, then it really brought it home just how vulnerable Shetland could be to attack. And there was a real sense that Britain could perhaps be taken from the north.
Indeed there was, yes. And so I say it was the same on both sides. Both the Germans feared we would invade and we feared that they would invade.
And Shetland was stuck in the middle.
Stuck in the middle, absolutely, yes.
Now, is there anything that you think that I've missed that you'd like to bring in or that we should speak about?
The problem with the Shetland Buffs is there are so many of these fascinating stories to tell. And if people want to look further, the film The Twelfth Man was released, about 3 years ago? That's the story of the Bratholm, the story of Jan Baalsrud's escape. And the Norwegians have made three films. I think there's a new one about to be released as well, based on the resistance up in the north of Norway. So there is quite a lot of source information if people are really interested to look into it.
I can put a link to all the books and films that you've spoken about. I can put a link in the show notes for this so that anybody that would like to read more or just find out more, they can do that.
Yeah. That's excellent. Yeah, that would save heaven to speak about it.
Well, listen, thank you very much for coming on and kind of just giving us a really good insight into what was a hugely important time in Shetland's history.
Oh, you're welcome. That's been very interesting.
Thank you for listening. This podcast can only be made possible by my supporters on Patreon, so a huge thank you to all my patrons. If you would like to support me in bringing you more of these shows, you can sign up and become a patron. You will find details about how to sign up in the show notes below or at www.patreon.com and just search Shetland with Laurie. And remember, you can find more on Instagram and give me a follow at Shetland with Laurie. So thank you once again for listening, and we will see you here next time. And in the meantime, safe and happy travels.